Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really delighted to be sitting opposite a Carthage colleague, Dr. Thomas Carr, who is Associate Professor of Biology, Director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology, Senior Science Advisor for the Dinosaur Discovery Museum here in Kenosha, and responsible for very, very exciting new research. And a bit of unanticipated drama was unfolding in our WGTD studios right at the top of the hour. Dr. Carr is here today to talk about the publication of his newest research, and that was publication that was to occur online at the top of the hour, roughly 12 minutes ago. And to be perfectly correct, Dr. Carr would not be in a position to share his exciting discovery on this program until that publication had in fact taken place. And there was quite the look of elation on Dr. Carr's face at 8 o'clock or 8:01, something like that, when he did a search. And there it was, a really exciting new publication of Dr. Carr's, which now he is at liberty to talk about, namely a new species of tyrannosaur. And we will be talking about its name, its appearance, its importance, and the long, arduous road that Dr. Carr has taken to make all of this possible. And we'll even hear about the really serious broken leg that he suffered through the course of this all too exciting story. Dr. Thomas Carr, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I bet it is, because you have something so fun and exciting to talk about. And it's interesting that as you brought this to my attention, the possibility of coming on the morning show and talking about the publication of your latest research, you were very careful not to, in a sense, let on too much about just how exciting this was. We should probably take our listeners out of a sense of suspense.
Sure.
Let's just shortly, briefly explain exactly what you have done here, what was published as of now 14 minutes ago, and then we'll explore the long story behind it.
Sure. The article, as you mentioned, was published at the top of the hour in Scientific Reports. The title is "A New Tyrannosaur with Evidence for Anagenesis in a Crocodile-like Sensory System." And although I'm the lead author, I had an exceptional team of co-authors, which included David Vericchio, who's a paleontologist at the Museum of the at Montana State University in Bozeman, the extraordinary anatomist Jake Zadelmeyer at the Health Sciences Center of the Louisiana State University, geochronologist Eric Roberts at James Cook University in Australia, and finally the paleontologist and geologist Jason Moore at the Honors College of University of New Mexico.
So you as a team have, in a sense, isolated and named and explained much about a new species of tyrannosaur.
Yeah, I guess I should get to that. For those of you out there in the know, there's been a tyrannosaur that's been bouncing around the literature for 25 years. When it was debuted to the scientific community, it wasn't named. It was just called a metaspecies. And
does that term mean?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
But this is what has come to be known as the two-medicine tyrannosaurine. It's a fairly advanced tyrannosaur. And in terms of our reconstructions of tyrannosaur evolution, it's always been very close to very well, relatively well-known tyrannosaur called Displetosaurus, Displetosaurus terosus, which was named in 1970 by Dale Russell, then at the Canadian Museum of Nature. And with regard to the two-medicine tyrannosaurine, we've known really nothing about it aside from that inaugural paper back in 1992. The original specimen was found in the late 80s, I think 1989, and it was published in 92 in Nature by Jack Horner and David Verrecchio and Mark Goodwin, who's at Berkeley.
So 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's been took 25 years to give this thing a name and find its proper place in a tyrannosaur family tree. But the origins in terms of the science does have bearing on what we've done today. So it was originally thought to be a transitional species between Displetosaurus on the one hand, which lived earlier in geological time, and Tyrannosaurus rex that lived later in geological time. So it was thought that Displetosaurus terosus morphed into this metaspecies, which then morphed into T. rex. And what we've done is we put that hypothesis to the test, and we agree with half of it. We agree that we have a new tyrannosaur, which we have named Displetosaurus horneri, which is Horner's frightful lizard. This is named for Dr. Jack Horner, formerly curator at the Museum of the Rockies. And so it's in honor of Jack and his contributions to paleontology, in particular his excavations of dinosaurs in the Two Medicine Formation. That's where this moniker, Two Medicine, comes from. It's a unit of rock roughly 75, 74 million years ago. And also, Jack has launched a lot of scientific careers, very successful ones, through his mentorships of students who have worked on Two Medicine dinosaurs and other fossils.
Let's talk a moment about the specimen itself.
Yeah.
So was that discovered, dug up 25 years ago or even longer ago than that?
Yes. It was discovered, I think, in 1989. I've heard a bit of the original story where one of the crew of the Museum of the Rockies sort of went off walking on her own, picked up a piece of dinosaur bone and brought it back to the rest of the crew. And I think the Museum of the Rockies technician, Bob Harmon, saw this bone fragment and knew what it was immediately. It was a piece of the nasal bone, the snout of a tyrannosaur. So they immediately rushed over to their locality. And fortuitously, the entire top of the skull was exposed to view below a very low hill. And so it was, I imagine it would have been a fairly straightforward specimen to collect. But since that time, so in 92, this enigmatic black silhouette of the skull was published. I mean, that was it. So all there was this black shape to give people an indication of what this animal looked like. But then in later years, in say, popular books, photographs of this specimen, its technical number, its accession number is MOR, Museum of the Rockies, 590. And 590 has since sort of become one of the signature fossils of the Museum of the Rockies since it's been in popular books written by Jack and others. But it's always been this an enigma, even though myself and other paleontologists have included it in our analyses. It did take a very long time to actually, you know, do the job and describe it, name it, and place it.
Right. I don't remember if you said this in your description. How complete a specimen was this?
Right. 590 is fairly complete. A lovely skull. It's almost all there, especially the left side, and you can see that in the publication. Has a brain case, which is a very important region of the skull that encloses the brain, has a lot of information. It's important in terms of understanding their intelligence and sensory system and also where they fit in a tyrannosaur tree. MOR 590 also has a complete leg, and which is very informative as well for getting a handle on the size of the animal, for making size comparisons, and also for getting a chronological age of the animal. And another team is actually working out the chronological age of horneri. So we don't include that, but we do present a growth series of Horneri. We have portions of juveniles, 590, even though its skull's almost a meter long, turns out to be a subadult, relatively young animal. And there's also a full adult Horneri. Its number is MOR 1130. And so we have really good representation of the growth of this tyrannosaur, and it's quite comparable to the major growth trends that we see in other tyrannosaurs. And above and beyond that, there's some growth trends that tyrannosaurs share, including Horneri, with other dinosaurs. So we've really sort of put together as complete a package as possible for this dinosaur to give it its due.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr, who heads up the Institute of Paleontology at Carthage College. And as of 8 o'clock this morning, the world now knows of the work that he has been doing recently, he and a team of paleontologists, for naming and explaining the place and time of a new species of tyrannosaur, Displetosaurus horneri. So Dr. Carr, it sounds like this has been kind of an intriguing puzzle for quite some time. But at what point did you decide to devote considerable time and energy towards this question?
Right.
And what sort of prompted you? I mean, given all that you are also responsible for, at what point did it make sense for you to undertake a challenge like this?
Sure. Back in 2007, I made my first research trip. I think it was a three-week trip to the Museum of the Rockies as a graduate PhD. It was my first official research trip there, not as a student. And that initial project was to gather data for a big study of T-Rex growth. And by the way, folks, of those of you out there listening, that study will almost certainly be ready for publication in the fall, so that's on its way. These projects do take some time. And while there, I did get data from 590 and 1130, these what were to become Horneri. And in the fall of that year, I sort of worked up the courage to float the idea to Jack Horner. During that initial trip, that three-week trip, Jack and I sort of got to know each other fairly well for the first time. Hmm. And it turns out that we think alike. We both think ontogenetically. We think in terms of growth and what that means for evolution. So we had a lot in common. And it just seemed to me that I was well positioned to take on the project. And he encouraged me to speak to the second author, David Riccio, whether or not David would be interested in going forward with it, since David had been collecting a lot of tyrannosaur material and other dinosaurs from the Two Medicine Formation. So it was a natural thing for us to work on together. And so at that point, the project moved forward, I think, a couple years later.
Hmm. Let me just ask, did you need to have, in a sense, their permission or someone's permission, or could essentially anybody in your position go about doing this work? I mean, and I suppose part of that question is, did you need to gain access to this specimen, for instance, in order to properly study it and ultimately come to the conclusion you did?
Yeah, in terms of vertebrate paleontology and, you know, for the sciences, and I think for just any profession, there is a protocol to follow. You just can't, you know, swoop in and scoop up someone's material for a project. I mean, that would be unethical. And so a lot of the way forward depends on gaining people's trust and confidence and building those relationships, demonstrating competence to do the work, so on and so forth. So yes, I think access is, you know, does have to be worked on, and that's an important part of how our science is done, certainly. Mm. So that was nothing unusual.
So we're roughly talking about a decade's worth of work, then, it sounds like, or maybe not even quite that long in terms of concerted effort. But
I think we really got moving on this probably 2 or 3 years ago, although in the meantime I had been working on a larger monograph on Horneri. It's over 1,000 pages and will be published as a book. And I joke with Jack that, you know, it's going to be the great unread monograph. You know, who'd bother? But what that does is describe in stark raving detail the osteology, the anatomy of Horneri in terms of its growth. So everything's in there. It'll be a very comprehensive work, and that won't see light of day for some years. In the meantime, we did make it a priority to publish a shorter paper that diagnoses it, names it, places it, you know, within the big picture of transfer evolution, put out the growth series, and also say some things about its evolution and also the appearance of tyrannosaurs.
Right.
So we pack a lot into this paper.
Right. Help us understand kind of the way you and your teammates worked over the last 3 years. And did this involve a lot of discussion and even argument? I mean, or generally speaking, did you work very cohesively, and did all of you from the beginning sort of have a sense of the same ultimate goal?
It was an exceptional group of collaborators, exceptional group of scientists. It went pretty smoothly. You know, effectively, I think, if memory serves, I just sort of assigned tasks, and everyone did their part. So myself and Dave Riccio covered the anatomy paleontology aspect of it, as well as Jason Moore, Jake Zadelmeyer and myself took on the soft tissue, the appearance question of tyrannosaurs. Jake is an expert on archosaur, that is birds, dinosaurs, and crocodilians, an expert on their head anatomy, and really knows their blood vessels and nerves very well. And Eric Roberts worked on the geochronology. And this is actually a part that I don't want to undersell, is Eric really went the distance in making sure that we had solid radiometric dates for pinning down exactly the age of these ash bed horizons within the Two Medicine Formation. It was very important for us to know when Horneri lived and to establish whether it lived after its antecedent, Diplodocus terosus. Mm. So that was critical to this hypothesis of anagenesis, that one species morphed into the other over geological time.
Right.
So that was a very important part. And it is effectively, I sent out a template of the manuscript, and people would just add their parts or revise parts. And it was a very smooth experience, just through emails. Hmm. It's research by email.
Right.
Imagine that.
Well, right, as opposed to what this would have felt like or how it would have unfolded. For instance, 25 years ago, would have been a very, very different sort of effort.
Yep.
Explain a little more about this term, which is right in the title of the paper that was published at the top of the hour. Anagenesis.
So it's thought that evolution, at least as it works for things like backboned animals and insects and plants, has two major ways of happening, producing new species. The most common is called cladogenesis, and all that means is that an ancestral species will get split either by, say, a seaway cutting a continent in two, such as happened in North America 100 million years ago. So an ancestral population gets split by some external force like that and produces two or more daughter populations. Natural selection works on those, and they become different over time. So that's splitting speciation. That's a technical term.
And geographically they're split, and then they become split in other
then
ways.
Off they go in their own directions under the hands, you know, the formless hand of natural selection. Now, the other version, which isn't as common, is where an ancestral population just morphs through geological time from one species into the other. And all that's happening is natural selection is pushing its genotype, its morphology off in some new direction over time without splitting. And so we think that we have evidence for that process. And it's a fairly bold claim. It's a claim that paleontologists aren't comfortable making, because you have to have solid evidence for it. And we have four criteria that we followed, and that is that the species in question must be close relatives, and it turns out Horneri and Trosus are each other's closest relative. They must be within the same geological area, so they're adjacent, Montana for Horneri, Alberta for, or was now Alberta for Trosus. They also must be successive in time, and this is why the geochronology was so important, the work that Robert did. And we found that Trosus did precede Horneri in time. They're separated by a gap of about 100,000 years. So we can check that one off. The last criterion is that the relationships don't contradict that sequence of change. And since Horneri and Trosus are each other's closest relatives, we can check that one off as well. So effectively what we're saying is, even though our family trees look like everything is produced by cladogenesis, we have enough evidence to suggest that maybe the transition from one species to another didn't happen that way. We have enough evidence to suggest that maybe Diplodocus trosus morphed into Horneri, became different over time under the hand of natural selection. And they are recognizably different. If you put them side by side, they do differ. They don't differ in extreme ways like you'd expect for creatures that would be more remotely related. But we do think there is enough evidence to suggest, at least, that we have this direct ancestry from one animal to another.
Interesting. And one of your criteria, just to drive this point home, involves geography. That
yes.
if one of these specimens was from Montana, but the other one was from Venezuela, then most likely this would be the first kind of evolutionary development that you were describing, in which one species gets split geographically for whatever reason, and then they each evolve differently. So
yeah.
they must be in close enough proximity that it is likely that this is one species the whole time.
Yeah, and that's a really good point that you raised, because some distances are too far. You know, that would stretch the hypothesis, you know, to the breaking point. And also some land areas just weren't connected. So it matters where the animals were from. And at the time of Diplodocus, Horneri, and Trosus, they lived on a continuous landmass called Laramidia, basically the western Rocky Mountain region. And so there was no impediment geographically from accessing one region from the other. It was effectively a continuous coastal plain that was produced by the Young Rocky Mountains.
Right. We've not yet gotten to what I think is one of the most exciting and also accessible aspects of what you have published, namely the appearance of this new species, and in particular the appearance of its face, what the face of Diplodocus horneri looked like. And it is really intriguing, the illustration that you have here. Mm-hmm. And you are making claims about, in a sense, the exterior of
yes.
Of the skull, the face of this tyrannosaur, that I don't think we've ever seen before. I mean, this looks like nothing I've ever seen in terms of an illustration of a dinosaur. Explain what you believe Diplodocus horneri looked like, and what leads you to that claim.
Right. Well, this is one sort of slice of the pie that Dr. Zadelmeyer and I worked on pretty closely together. And the basic question was, since we have these fantastic specimens of horneri, the preservation's great. We can see every detail, including the texture of the facial bones. And if you've ever stared a tyrannosaur in the face, you'll see that they have a wonderfully rich texture. It's quite variable over the face. It's a rough texture. There's a variety of bumps and swales and grooves. And that's quite variable. The top of the snout is really rough, for example, and there's little horns elsewhere on the face. But overall, there's this rough texture. And I've always wondered, ever since I started working on tyrannosaurs back in 1993, that I just wondered what's up with that. And what we've learned is that bone is a dynamic, responsive tissue. Bone is shaped by soft tissues. And in 2009, there was a wonderful study done on the appearance of horned dinosaurs. This was done by Tobin Hieronymus and authors. And they really took on the task of working out exactly what textures on animal faces like reptiles and birds and such. And all of you out there, forgive me for using the term reptile, but it's convenient and useful. And mammals. And so they actually did the dissection work. They did the very close comparative analyses and worked out the signatures in terms of texture and also signatures in terms of openings of nerves on the face and jaws and exactly what those textures and openings correlate to in terms of the covering. Mm. So it turns out that, say, horn, like beaks, you know, on birds and the horn that covers the casks, say, on hornbills and cassowaries, leave a certain texture. Scales.
When it's gone,
when it's removed on the underlying bone.
You can see where it was, yes. And yeah. That impression, whatever it happens to be, is evidence then, oh, there was a horn there.
Yes, so okay. A covering of horn, and say, for example, horn leaves a distinct rim around its edges, and the blood vessel nerve grooves are very deep and sharp-edged and usually are long. So there's criteria like that. And so we took Hieronymus et al.'s work as a starting point. Dr. Zedelmeyer brought to the table his expertise in the head anatomy, particularly the vasculature and nerves of the archosaur head. And so combining these two approaches, we also extended the comparison data set. We include crocodilians. And as it turned out, to make a long story short, it turns out that tyrannosaurs have an unexpectedly rich set of textures on their heads that include large flat scales, as we see on alligators and other crocodilians, and that's the dominant texture on the face. It's this very coarse, wrinkly texture. And
it looks
a dead
like,
ringer for crocodilians.
Right, and it looks from the illustration you have here, like, for instance, most of the snout.
Yeah.
The upper and lower parts of the snout are covered in this sort of mottled texture that we think of with, for instance, the typical crocodile.
Yeah, and so it's effectively a mask of large flat scales. But within that, there's several zones, and zones of very coarse little bumps, very rough. This is at the front of the snout. It extends onto the top of the snout. There's patches of it on the sides of the lower jaws. And that texture is evidence of armor-like skin. So like in a rhinoceros, very tough skin. And it's not too hard to imagine that maybe there'd be some advantage to that, such as, you know, during feeding and protecting, you know, the animal's face being protected from scrapes by splintered bone, that sort of thing. We really don't know, but intuitively that makes sense. A strange thing is that we found this armor-like skin, evidence for it, on the horns in front of the eyes and also below the cheeks, and that surprised me, but we have to go where the evidence leads. And the third tissue type we found was horn, like, you know, fingernails or beaks or claws. So this keratin, very effectively just a keratin sheath that covered the horn behind the eye, and where we have, and also extends sort of down the bar behind the eye too. And the evidence for that is, you know, there's this raised rim. You can actually see where the horn stops, the horn covering stops. So we have this hypothesis that is not just applicable to Hornerai. This is the face of all the large tyrannosaurs. They all have this pattern of textures. They all had this three-part mask.
Interesting. So just as we think back to the illustrations we've seen in books or what we saw in Jurassic Park or something like that, Essentially we saw what looked like fairly generic-looking reptilian skin that was that the entire Tyrannosaurus was covered in. with no variation whatsoever. And what you are suggesting is that perhaps the face of all of these tyrannosaurs was actually comprised of several different textures and, yeah. and something really quite dramatically different from what we have ever seen before.
Yeah, yeah, what really stood out was a similarity to crocodilians, and I guess I could give a brief backstory to this. In the year about, for several years, I'd been taking note, while working on the big monograph, I'd been taking note of the foramina. These are the openings that emit nerves and blood vessels onto the face. So they look like a bunch of holes in the snout. And I've been paying close attention to those because I knew that if they're at a certain angle and had a certain form, they're evidence for a covering of horn-like beak. And so actually for, I probably shouldn't confess this, but just based on that line of evidence, I ignored the texture. I just fixated on the foramina. And so for about 2 years, I was convinced that tyrannosaurs had giant beaks, covered their entire, almost their entire heads.
Wow.
And it wasn't until I actually got to the project in earnest with Jake Zadelmeyer, where I realized that this giant beak concept was completely wrong. Huh. But instead, we had something much more interesting and something that makes a lot more sense if we consider archosaur evolution as a whole. One upshot of the flat scale hypothesis, which is based on the direct evidence of the bone texture, is that modern crocodilians have this facial covering of flat scales. And like tyrannosaurs, crocodilians have a lot of these little openings in their snout for twigs of the trigeminal nerve, which, among other things, brings back tactile sensations from the skin. And if you ever look a crocodilian in the face closely, you'll see on their scales are these little black bumps. And these little bumps are called ISOs, integumentary sensory organs. They're effectively little thin domes above a very above clusters of nerve endings. Highly sensitive, and biologists have studied this and found that the crocodilian snouts are as sensitive as human fingertips, if not more so. Now, if there's a causal relationship between the flat scale type and presence of these little organs, then there's no reason to think they were absent from tyrannosaurs. And given the similarity of bone texture, number, and density of these foramina, we do make that hypothesis that ISOs were present in tyrannosaurs, and tyrannosaurs had highly sensitive snouts, just like crocodilians. And so they would gather a lot of information through just touch about their world and each other, just like crocodilians. And so in terms of the other part of the title, the third part, the crocodilian-like sensory system, that's what it's an allusion to. And on the diagram that we published, we had our illustrator, Dino Pallera, very talented illustrator, include the ISOs on the face.
And just so I understand correctly, so we're talking specifically about the sense of touch?
Yes.
Okay. So not any of the other senses being right. heightened.
Right. Right. So we sort of in loosely call this now hypersensitive, just to make that one-to-one comparison with crocodilians. The simplest hypothesis for the presence of this sensory system in tyrannosaurs and crocodilians is common ancestry. So we make a prediction that the evidence for this sensory system will be seen in the common ancestor of what ultimately led to crocs and tyrannosaurs. And so the evidence for that will come from a couple sources. A close examination of the facial texture and the nerve openings in the faces of the animals that are on the big family tree that lead along the way to tyrannosaurs on the one hand and crocodilians on the other. Also, this is a testable hypothesis from another point of view, and that is once someone finds a tyrannosaur mummy with skin preserved or skin impression preserved on the face, we'll really know what's going on, and that will be the test of whether or not we're off base. But we do think that for the time being, the hypothesis is strong. It's based on direct evidence, based on the bones themselves and what we know about the one-to-one correlation between overlying soft tissue and underlying bone texture.
Right. I'm a little surprised that this is something that hasn't been suggested before. Do you have any explanation for why no one has kind of come to this conclusion before you and your team did?
Well, over the years, there's been sort of a certain amount of, I guess, speculation about the appearance of dinosaurs in general, T-Rex in particular, given movies like Jurassic Park and such. And given the so when the publication on the horned dinosaur faces was published back in 2009, I thought to myself, well, someone's going to jump on this for tyrannosaurs. Someone can just apply these results to tyrannosaurs. You know, talk about low-hanging fruit. And it never happened. And so we took that opportunity and actually came up with something that, you know, hypothesis that I didn't expect from the outset. There has been some recent ideas that tyrannosaurs have, say, lips, sort of in the fashion of, you know, snakes and lizards. And our hypothesis rejects that conclusion, and the evidence that that's based on is sort of this meta-evidence based on enamel microstructure and tooth size, among other things. But our hypothesis is actually grounded on the bones themselves and what they tell us directly about the overlying soft tissues.
Right. So the conclusions you ended up making in what was published, that had to be submitted to someone and or something, and someone had to say, this looks right, versus this looks like crazy speculation.
Right.
So to whom did you submit these findings, or what ultimately was published less than an hour ago?
So I think as many of the listening audience might appreciate, that scientific knowledge is produced through a process called peer review. And what happens is a manuscript gets submitted to a journal, in this case Scientific Reports, and it was sent out to at least two reviewers. A paper will go out to two or three reviewers, some of which that the authors suggest, others that maybe the authors don't suggest. And so it went through that process, and the reviewers were satisfied that we had, you know, done our due diligence in providing evidence for not only this hypothesis, but actually the whole gamut. You know, new tyrannosaur growth series, anagenesis, appearance of the animal, sensory system, radiometric dates. So all that passed muster. And then after that process, reviewers will make suggestions for changes or refinements or expansions. And that certainly happened. And the funny thing was that I went on a three-week research trip back to the Museum of the Rockies this January, and 3 days before leaving, I received the reviews back. And so my first week of my three-week visit to the Museum of the Rockies was eaten up by doing the revisions, and a lot of it was focused on anagenesis and also illustrating the features that make horneri different from Trosis, which people will see on the supplementary material. At the end of that week, early in the morning, walking down the stairwell to the collections, I slipped and I broke my foot off my leg. Skeletally, it wasn't a compound fracture, so I actually broke my leg over this dinosaur in this paper, and I lost 4 days. And so I was back in collections to do revisions on the following Tuesday, broke my leg Friday the 13th. Not that I'm superstitious, but there it is. Back in collections on the following Tuesday, and the rest of the week went to taking care of the revisions, the suggestions that the reviewers made. So the comments we get back is something we take very seriously, and actually what sees the light of day is somewhat different from what originally went in, which is a good thing.
Right. You as lead writer, what does that mean in terms of your working relationship with all of the other skilled and knowledgeable paleontologists who are on your team?
Yeah, well, I herd the cats, and generally a lead author has his or her hands in most of the pots that are going, whereas the secondary, tertiary authors and so on may have more specialized tasks to take on, or in some cases more general tasks as well. It's variable, But this was a project that I had started, that I had made significant headway on. And I think, you know, there is also an understanding of what people will do and sort of what that will be proportionately among the group. So it is variable and, you know, cooperative and productive and all the rest of it. It's a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I bet. So tell us about Jack Horner's reaction to all of this. And first of all, what was there ever the possibility that he himself would want to undertake any of this kind of study of this specimen that he helped uncover a quarter of a century ago? Or is that not the kind of work in which he is engaged at this point?
Well, Jack has a thing about Tyrannosaurus, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying that. And if it was a target for his research, it would have happened a long time ago. And actually coming up with a name was Dave Riccio's suggestion. I liked it. I think the reasons were fantastic. I think, you know, an honorific is a great way to go for a name. And so I had to ask Jack permission, and his reaction was kind of funny. It was in the collections, and I said, Jack, you know, this is what we're thinking of the name for the two-med Tyrannosaurine, and, you know, we're thinking of calling it Horneri after you for these reasons. What do you think? And he just sort of looked at me. He sort of looked at the floor and put his hands, you know, his face in his hands, and said, you know, said something like, you know, some funny comment about being named for a Tyrannosaur, you know, since he's always on about T-Rex being a scavenger and dissing Tyrannosaurs. It was a funny moment.
Right. But he was ultimately honored, it sounds like, and to have his name attached to this brand new species. So explain where you go from here. You've already mentioned the fact that you are hard at work at what ultimately is going to be a 1,000-plus page monograph.
Yeah.
Explain what is involved in putting something like that together, besides tons of time.
Well, there's not much else. It's just tons of time in the Museum of the Rockies collections, taking measurements, just writing description, doing illustrations. Actually, my recent trip was supposed to be devoted to doing illustrations. I'd even crack one out. Just given the breaking my leg really interfered with my productivity, so I have to be back. I think beyond the monograph, the facial integument and sensory hypothesis has opened up an opportunity for Dr. Zadelmeyer and I to really take that question on and really sort of pursue the evolution of the trigeminal nerve. This is the major sensory nerve of the snout, and really sort of take that question on. So it's actually opened up new avenues for myself. It's maintained a collaboration, which is fantastic. And so there's, you know, many little threads that can come out of this. But sort of digging into the sensory anatomy of extinct animals is one of those.
Right. What does this do, if anything, in terms of the other work that you have done, in terms of the big excavation project in Montana, which you have been involved in for multiple summers? Has this put any of that, in a sense, on the back burner for you?
Not at all. There isn't. Yeah, they don't. They're sort of mutually exclusive in some ways. But in addition to the big study of growth in T-Rex that I hopefully will be completed this fall, I'm also working on a big comparative study of growth in all Tyrannosaurs. And this growth series that we published today for Horneri will be an integral part of that study, and the aim of it is to work out exactly how did Tyrannosaurs evolve, how did they become different based on what we see in growth. So in terms of my overall research program, this has been an integral and vital part. I just simply couldn't move ahead for this big comparative study without having Horneri established and having the growth series out there. So it's part of a foundation of a much bigger study.
Right. That's exciting to think about. So your plans for this coming summer, will you be back in Montana?
Yes. I'll be you know, whether I'm hobbling or not.
I was just going to say, with a serious break like this, that could make a little bit of difference, I suppose.
Yeah, we don't head out till late July, and I should be walking by then. I should be free of the crutches. If I, you know, hopefully I won't be dependent on a cane. We do rent a lodge, so if I can't go out onto exposure, I have plenty to work on back at the lodge. But I'll be out there with my team. We're going out to rescue some dinosaurs we ran out of time to collect last summer. And we'll also be participating in the Carter County Museum's annual Dino Shindig, where I'll be giving a talk on the face of Tyrannosaurus.
I should think a lot of people are going to enjoy that. And, of course, it will be intriguing to hear where your follow-up studies go. So once again, this was something of a morning show WGTD exclusive that the wider world for the first time is hearing in detail about this marvelous discovery of sorts that you have made and which was officially published just less than an hour ago.
Yeah.
The naming of a brand new Tyrannosaurus species, Displetosaurus horneri.
Yes.
Quite exciting. Dr. Thomas Carr, thank you for sharing this with us today with our morning show listeners. Your visits to the morning show are always exciting and fun, but this was in many ways especially so. We also wish you happy, smooth, uneventful healing from the broken leg, and we look forward to your further visits to the morning show. Well, thank you so much.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
You bet. Next week, we have some interesting morning shows, but we also want to remind you that tomorrow on the morning show, it's Dr. Jerry Mast, political science professor at Carthage College. And of course, there is no shortage of matters political for us to talk about with Professor Mast on tomorrow's morning show. On Monday, I'm excited to share with you my interview with Mary Otto, the author of a very interesting book called Teeth, that explores essentially the history of dental care in the United States and also explores the troubling disparity between access to dental care that is experienced by affluent Americans versus poor Americans. And on Tuesday, we'll be sharing with you an interview with Matthew Udry, who is the most recent winner of the Racine Symphony Youth Auditions and a very, very fine